Welcome back.
It's been a long time, hasn't
it's
it?
It's been, what, a month?
About a month.
Yeah, it's been a long time.
I think the last year we had was, by my calculation, was April 4th.
That's what I have in my math, the last thing, April 4th.
Right. It's a month.
Well,
anybody remember
exactly
what book we're learning?
Barely. I can tell you, that's it.
That's about it. I just wish I weren't. I wish a month you would have thought it'd be spring already.
Yeah.
That's true, too.
Four layers of clothes.
I don't have much for it.
Perek Yud Aleph. Pasuk Lamed Bet. No, sorry, Pasuk Chavtet. Is where we're up to. What we have looked at so far was the dialogue between Yiftach and Melech Bnei Amon, Moav Amon, joint nation, nationality, identity, kingdom at this time. We talked about that as well. And the effort that Yiftach goes through to try to avoid the battle, try to convince Melech Bnei Amon that he's got his history, he's got his facts wrong, what does he need this for, why didn't he come for the last 300 years? All of the claims, all of the arguments that Yiftach put forward to Melech Bnei Amon to counter his claim to the land went unheeded. And Pasuk Chavchet, which is the last Pasuk of that paragraph, reads, V'lo shama Melech Bnei Amon el divrei Yiftach asher shalach elav. Melech Bnei Amon refused to listen, refused to acknowledge the words of Yiftach. Which brings us to Pasuk Chavtet. Everybody with me? V'atehi al Yiftach ruach Hashem ve'avo et ha-gilad ve'et menashe. This phrase, Yiftach was inspired or came upon Yiftach, this Ruach Hashem, we've talked about this before, Ruach Hashem here is not to be confused with Ruach Hashem in other places where it talks about prophecy. This is not a function of prophecy. The Ruach Hashem in Sefer Yiftach is always an introduction to some battle, some military engagement, some effort that therefore is translated by the Targum as Ruach Gvurta min Kadam Hashem, spirit of courage, Gvura. Divinely inspired courage. Crosses over the Gilad and Menashe. On a map, the Gilad and Menashe essentially is one area. The area of the Gilad is the geographic region of Shevet Menashe. And if you cut across, you'll enter into the area, territorial area of Ammon, Moab, this region here, and that's where the battle takes place. Ve'avo et mitzpe gilad, umimitzpe gilad avar bnei amon. Mitzpe, meaning the mitzpe is where the army was gathered, his hometown, the jumping point for the battle, and engages in the army of bnei amon. Ve'idar Yiftach neder la'ashem v'yoma. Yiftach took an oath, made an oath at that time, saying, "Im naton titenet bnei amon biyadi, if God will give bnei amon into my hands, v'haya, hayotze asher yetze midaltei veti likrati, b'shuvi b'shalom ibnei amon, that which will emerge from the doors of my home to greet me when I return in peace from bnei amon." Translated that literally, intentionally, v'haya la Hashem v'ha'alitiu ola. It will be to God, and I will offer it, him, pronouns are unclear, as a sacrifice. Ve'avod Yiftach abnei Amon lilachem bam. Yiftach continues in the battle to wage war with Amon. Ve'itnem Hashem biyado. And God gives them into his hands. Ve'yakem me'aro'er ve'ad bo'achah minit esrim ir ve'ad avel kramim makah gdolah me'od. The names of the cities less significant for us. Aroer is mentioned in the story of the war with Sichon and Moab, but these are names of cities in the region. 20 cities. Yiftach is successful, conquers. Vayikan'u b'nei Amon v'p'nei b'nei Yisrael. B'nei Amon is subdued before Israel. Vayavo Yiftach haMitzpah el Beto. Yiftach goes home to Mitzpah, victorious in battle. V'hine vito yotzet likrato betupim uvimcholot. And out marches his daughter from the doors, from his house, with timbrel and dancing circles. V'rak hi yichida ein lo mimenu ben ovat. She is alone. Now, translating this phrase literally is a difficult task because the pronouns here are very confusing. Ein lo mimenu ben ovat. He has not from him son or daughter.
And here it says beside her, he had neither son or daughter.
Right. Well, beside her would be one interpretation, which we'll see in the Radak. The problem is that the pronoun mimenu is with a vav, not a hey. If it had said right. Ein lo mimena, beside her, but it says mimenu, which is problematic. We'll see in the Mefarshim, especially the Radak, will deal with this question. What does he mean? But the gist of the verse, whatever its literal meaning,
right.
In some way she's alone. She's an only child in some significant fashion. Therefore, when he sees that she is the one who walks out of the house in fulfillment of that oath that he took in the heat of battle, Hayotzea she etzei midaltei veti likrati, that which will emerge from the doors of my house to greet me, turns out that is hine bito yotzet likrato. Notice the phrase likrato in both cases. Pasuk. We should line these two psukim up. I'll do it afterwards. Pasuk lamed aleph. Hayotzea she etzei midaltei beti likrati. Pasuk lamed dalid. Vihine bito yotzet likrato. Vayichir oto ota. As he sees her, vayikrat bagadav. Tears kriya. Rents his garment. Vayome, aha biti, whoa, my daughter, hachreya hichra'atini. Hachreya hichra'atini is atayit bo'achri is you have troubled me, or you are the source of my troubles. You have subdued me. Hachreya hichra'atini. How do they translate hachreya hichra'atini?
Want me low?
Yeah, subdued me. You are at hayit ba'ochri. Ocher is a very harsh word. In modern Hebrew, we say mayim akurim, or muddied waters. Right? Achor is something which is dirty, something which is classically used when Achan took from the cherim in Yericho. Remember the story in Yeshua. So Yeshua calls him Ocher Yisrael, the trouble of Israel. Similarly, you have this phrase used by Goliath, is called Ocher Yisrael. Eliyahu and Achav have this great debate between them, where Achav calls Eliyahu Hanavi after he's decreed a drought in Israel. He says, Ocher Yisrael, and Eliyahu responds to Achav and he says, no, you are the Ocher Yisrael. We have a nice conversation about who the Ocher Yisrael is. Va'at hayit ba'ochri. You are my troubles. Why? Anochi patziti pi el Hashem. I've opened my mouth to God. I took an oath. V'lo chal lashuv. I can't retract it. Vatomer elav. She said back to him, Avi, patzita et picha l'Hashem, my father, you've opened your mouth to God. Aseli kashi yetza mipicha. Do unto me what has come out of your mouth. Acharei asher asalacha Hashem nekamot me'evecha mipnei amon. After all, God kept his side of the bargain. God helped you be victorious against Bnei Amon. You have an obligation to keep your side of the deal. Do to me whatever you have spoken. However, but she further asks one more request. Give me 2 months. Leave me. Let me be for 2 months.
Let
Let me go down to the mountains and mourn or cry over my virginity, over my not being a young maiden, not married, for 2 months. He sends you for 2 months. And they cry over her status as a virgin, as unmarried, for 2 months on the mountains. After 2 months, she comes back to her father, quite willingly. And he did to her his oath which he had taken. One of the most poignant euphemisms employed in Tanakh. He fulfilled his oath to her, or upon her. She never having known a man, vati chok b'Yisrael, such was now the law in Israel, the custom in Israel, miyamim yamima, tilachna benot Yisrael, letanot levat yiftach ha-giladi arba'a yamim b'shana. New custom in Israel, 4 days a year, the daughters of Israel would go to mourn, to cry over Bat Yiftach. All right. Strange is not the word. This is a remarkable, remarkable story, and it raises so many questions. So many questions.
Well, it's the same thing about Yaakov and Rachel, and when Laban asks him for his trophim, and he says, "If you find them, you know you can kill the person who has them."
He never says that.
What is it?
Careful.
But it's very
completely different.
No,
it's completely different. He doesn't say, "If you find them, you can kill them." He says, "Whoever has taken the trophim shall die."
Yeah.
Right. He doesn't find them. Yaakov doesn't kill her. Neither does Laban. It's a profound difference between Yaakov's statement as a kind of exaggeration because he's so sure of himself that nothing's going to happen. And in the end, he doesn't kill Rachel in fulfillment of his oath. God forbid.
No, I'm not saying he does it, but I'm saying
he
makes this statement out of ignorance because he's so sure. In the end, she still dies.
The assumption that she dies because of his oath is an assumption. It never says that in the text. It never makes any kind of association to that effect. It can be any number of reasons why she dies, including the fact that she was pregnant throughout the journey and she dies in childbirth. You know, her death may or may not be related theologically, esoterically, to his plitat peh, to his slip of the tongue. Yiftach takes an oath in public in the midst of battle that he is going to take the first one who comes out of his house and offer him or her as a sacrifice, and lo and behold, it's his daughter, and he fulfills his neder.
It's a weird oath anyway.
A weird oath. Let's start from the beginning. Let's list the questions. Right? Before we begin to try to address, we're going to spend at least 2 weeks trying to make heads or tails out of the oath and the resolution of this oath. But let's try to understand the issues. Right? What are the questions?
Why did he have to make this oath?
Why did he have to make an oath in the midst of battle? We don't know a lot about this battle. But something motivated him in the midst of this battle to take this kind of an oath. What kind of an oath is it? Is it precedented? Do we have examples of it? What's going on?
And if he's making an oath, why does he make an oath that he's going to dedicate all that he captures from the B'nai Ammon to Hashem?
Let him. There's a concept of Chayim. Let him take whatever the spoils of war. Or something specific. He makes this incredibly ambiguous oath. Asher yetze midalte beti likrati b'shuvi b'shalom. The one that which will emerge from the doors of my house. So, what did he expect? That was my question, right? What was he expecting? What was he expecting? What was going to walk out of his house to greet him upon his return? His cow? Or his wife? Right? He has no other children. So it's either his cow or his chicken.
Or his dog,
which is a problem because you can't bring a dog on the mizbeach either. Or his wife. What was he expecting?
A cow.
Right. Midalte Beiti, if it was the one that emerges from my corral, the barn, or my farm, it's one thing. But Midalte Beiti is very specific. The doors of my house. What, he kept his cow in his house? Kept his cow in his living room? The entire context of this oath is remarkable. It's either the height of stupidity.
But why didn't he take it for himself? Like, why didn't he do it to himself? Why would he say... You know what I'm saying? What, if he was taking the oath, he should have done it on himself personally, no?
No, I think it was a very public oath. Very public oath.
No, she means that it would affect him himself.
Right.
Well, it is. It's taking the first thing that walks out of his house.
I know, but I mean, but not directed to somebody else,
to himself. Make himself? Even in Molech, they didn't offer themselves the sacrifices, they offered the children.
Oh, well.
Well, so much better.
Right, exactly. I rest my case. That's right. I rest my case. It's a remarkable story. And on top of it, once we figure out what his intention was, if he meant an animal, so work through the logic. If he meant some sort of a sacrifice, a cow, a chicken, a
but
dog, a cat,
it wouldn't have been from his
right,
door.
Then it wouldn't have been from his door. But even if it was, if you make an oath intending to offer a sacrifice and it happens to be that the criteria you set ends up being a person, does that mean that the oath is valid? Mandates you to offer a human being as a sacrifice?
You're not allowed to do that.
It's so grotesque. It's so antithetical to Torah. Such a thing as an oath has to be valid. It has to, chal, as they say in halachic terminology, it has to be valid on something. So why does he claim that he has no choice but to obey the words of his oath when they have no halachic validity whatsoever? And if he intended it to be a human sacrifice, or what was going through his mind that he's going to bring a human being as a sacrifice, we have no, has no context in Jewish life whatsoever. And
you
of
would
course,
think Hashem would accept
it. Yeah. It doesn't actually say that Hashem accepted it.
No, but that he wouldn't be Matzliach, because his intentions were so evil that he was going to sacrifice.
You mean the battle?
Him.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And then, of course, we have this very strange euphemism at the end of the story. Vayas la et nidro asher nadar. He performed the oath which he had oathed.
Sworn.
Which he had taken. In other words, what does that mean?
He sacrificed
his daughter.
Does it?
Daughter.
Does it? And why doesn't he say vayakriveh ola? Are you sure he sacrificed? Where does it say that he actually sacrificed her?
It doesn't.
All it says is that he fulfilled his oath.
Well, what was his oath?
Well, we don't know what his oath is. So if we figured out what his oath is, we can figure out.
I thought his oath was he would sacrifice the first thing that walked out of his door.
That's what it sounds like. But that would transform Yiftach into somebody who's bringing
her,
human sacrifices, which is problematic for Shofet Bisrael. But it doesn't actually say that he offered her as a sacrifice.
Yeah,
it's
we also know she died after that.
Who says she died?
Because they mourn her.
What are they mourning?
They're mourning her virginity.
Correct.
Her lack of,
they mourn her virginity. What are they mourning?
She was not.
Right. They're mourning the fact that she was never married.
But it says, Wes, and it's in. Mem, it says, with Tanot,
right?
Yiftach, to
correct.
Mourn her. It doesn't say a virginity there. It says to mourn her.
You have to, it's two phrases you have to work together. V'hi lo yada ish, pasuk lametet. She never knew a man, but v'hi chok miyam b'Yisrael miyam. Miyamim etelachna b'not Yisrael letanot lebat Yiftach. I just raise it as a question.
Banished her somewhere. Put her somewhere else.
Maybe it was such a horrific thing that that's why they use the poetic thing.
100%.
You know?
100%. So here's the story. Here's what we're going to do. Our task is to work through not only the text, but also I want to work through all the mafashim, because it's such a complicated story and has become so controversial. One of the most controversial passages in Tanakh. It really behooves us to understand the primary sources in Chazal, in the Mefarshim, just to get a sense of what's going on. And then from that, we will be hopefully be able to put together some sort of a picture as to what's going on. What's fascinating to me is that there really are two major schools of thought to how to understand the whole story. And they revolve around this last phrase, Vayaslat Nidva Shenadar. What was the end result of this story? The end result of what happened to Bat Yiftach will tell us what his oath was, what he intended, and everything else that will come with it. What was the final result? What did it look like? Did it look like a human being being offered as a sacrifice on the altar? Or did it look like something else? And here the basic schools of thought divide into two categories. On the one hand, you have pretty much almost a uniform position of all the midrashic rabbinic sources, the Gemara, the Medrash, pretty much across the board. Chazal, as a whole, have one approach to the story, and in line with that approach is the Ramban. And then you have an alternative vision or interpretation that is offered by pretty much the classic Mefarshim, Hadak, Ibn Ezra, Mitzvah David, etc., everybody except the Ramban. And to my mind, it's a very interesting study in commentary, because traditionally, what we expect is for Chazal to take a more midrashic, homiletic, softening approach to the story, and for the Mefarshim to look for the more literal reading of the text. And what you actually end up with here is, I think, the exact opposite. Chazal, and in their footsteps the Ramban, across the board, are of the opinion that Bat Yiftach was offered as a sacrifice and died on the altar.
There are people who believe it.
That's how Chazal understood it. That's how the rabbis in the Gemara understood it. That's how the Medrash understood the story. That's how the Ramban understands the story. That's the classic, traditional, party-line story of Bat Yiftach, is that Yiftach sacrificed her as an offering. The Mefarshim, Radak, Ibn Ezra, Abarbanel, almost as a group, are so unwilling to go that direction, which is the literal reading of the text, that they interpret the story differently, and that she never dies. What he does to her banishes her, doesn't let her get married, whatever the story is. We'll see when we get to that school of reasoning. But not human sacrifice. Reinterpret the text. We're not talking about an ola, we're talking about some sort of monastery type of existence where she's never married, never gets married, and it's her ability to get married that's under question and being mourned for this discussion. And I've always found it fascinating that in this particular story, it's Chazal that take the literal reading of the text, and the Mefarshim that take what I would call the more midrashic or more interpretive approach to the text. Probably intuitively, they were just too uncomfortable with the sense that Yiftach could be somebody that sacrificed a human being. It just doesn't make any sense.
Do we get to choose which one we want?
In the end, you'd be happy to choose, but we're going to work them through. We're going to work through both.
And why didn't he null and void? Why didn't?
Oh, that's the third question.
Do that.
Right. That's the third question. The third question, which Chazal deal with head on, is if we're talking about an oath, the Torah has a mechanism for dealing with oaths that are problematic. It's called Hatarat Nedarim. And there's a simple solution to the problem. Just Hatarat Nedarim. If Yiftach made an oath and he didn't intend it for it to refer to his daughter, and behold, his daughter walked out the door, simple solution. Just deal with the oath and Hatarat Nedarim, convene a Bezdin, and it's done. That question Chazal will deal with, that'll be the third subject that we're going to do. So those are the three primary issues that we are going to have to deal with in this story. School number one, Chazal and the Ramban, that he actually killed her. School number two, Radak, Ibn Ezra, Mitzvah David, that he banished her or set her up in some kind of a monastic nunnery type of life. And question number three, which goes back to the oath, is what happened to the ability to annul or to deal with oaths on a different level. So we're going to take this one step at a time. We're going to take one approach at a time. Today I want to deal with the first approach, which is that of Chazal, that in fact we're dealing with a very literal reading of the text. He offers a human sacrifice, and his daughter pays the price.
The Darim is such a central part, you know, certainly of the davening.
Today it certainly is, but I mean, how central it was in the...
That wasn't central at that point?
How central it was, we'll see. There's a lot of information we have to get through before we can get to that question, but it's a very important question. We will address it. So the first approach assumes a very little reading of the text, namely that he offers some kind of human sacrifice and he in fact brings her as a sacrifice, which raises the other side of the question which we asked before, which is, what was his intention? What did he expect? That he's clearly not happy that his daughter walked out of the house. What was he expecting to walk out of the house? And even that question subdivides into two parts, or into two sub-schools of thought, namely, what was the possibility that he could contemplate? What are the options? Right? If his oath is that whoever, right? Pronouns in Hebrew are tricky because in English we have different pronouns for human beings and for inanimate objects. Right? Your pronoun for an inanimate object would be an it. Pronoun for a human being would be a who. Whereas in Hebrew, the same pronoun is used for both. So I can't distinguish from the pronoun whether he meant
animal, vegetable,
or mineral.
The first animal that came out?
Right, you could have. And then the pronoun in English would be an it. In Hebrew, it would be a who. But again, that comes back to the question I asked at the beginning of this year, which is, what was he expecting a cow to walk out of his living room? Yeah. Remember, he says, "Ashi yotzei midaltei beiti likrati b'shuvi b'shalom." The it is walking out of his door, of his front door of his house, to greet him upon his return from battle. So Elsie the cow is going to come out to greet him when he returns home from battle? Problematic, right? So either he meant a person, just not his daughter, which raises the question on an even larger scale, who he did mean, right? Especially because he only has one child, right? Unless he meant that he had many sons and only one daughter, in which case he couldn't care less about his sons. It's also possible, but didn't expect it to be a daughter. I don't know. Right?
It doesn't seem like she would be put in a position in the hierarchy of being preferred.
Anything is possible here. Or he meant an animal, but an animal. Remarkable statement. So here, too, we divide up. And there are midrashic sources that understand Yiftach as contemplating a human being walking out of his house. And I have midrashic sources that suggest that he had meant an animal would walk out of his house. So let's take a look at what we have. Start with actually an obscure medrash, but one that I found in a source called Midrash Ben Sira. Found it in the Otsar Midrashim, and I actually retyped it, and I apologize, I made a typing error. This medrash deals with the whole question of, globally, what kind of a person is Yiftach?
What kind of culture is it? I mean, maybe
what kind of a culture? So that's the question.
Unusual.
So says Ben Sira, right? Says Ben Sira, Medrash Ben Sira, Haya, this Yiftach, Hayat Tzadik, was originally a righteous person. However, Vada im Shechinim Re'im, but he had bad neighbors.
What bad neighbors?
Uh-huh. Bad neighbors. Bad cultural influence from his Shechinim. Now, here is the one piece of this medrash which I disagree with, meaning that I think the medrash is being euphemistic, in that the Shechenim Ra'im that the Medrash refers to are Mishevet Ephraim. Now, how Shevet Ephraim mixed into this, I have no idea. The only context in which we have a discussion between Yiftach and Ephraim is in Perek Yud Bet, when Ephraim reject Yiftach's leadership and they come to him in his insubordination and rejection, and Yiftach's so angry at them that he slaughters them in a bloodbath, 42,000. That doesn't sound to me like Shechenim Ra'im that Yiftach is so influenced by. So I think actually it's either a misprint or it's some kind of a euphemistic reference to a different group of people that are influencing Yiftach's culture, but referred to here as Shevet Ephraim because of what happens in Perek Yud Bet. Be that as it may, the Medrash suggests that this Yiftach may have started out as a tzaddik. However, he had bad cultural influence. Vira'ah, he saw. Shayus sorfim, that's the typing error. The reish and the pair makes are backwards. Vera'a shayus sorfim et b'nehem et b'notehem leBaal. He saw that in this culture they were sacrificing their sons and daughters to Baal. Va'afu asachin. So he also fell in line with the cultural sacrificial rite of his day. Halach v'harag et bito. So he went and he sacrificed, he killed his daughter. So if there's any question as to the status of Yiftach, this Medrash resolves it and says, why do we need to defend a person who is a Rasha and an evil person? He's an evil person. We know what evil people look like. Evil people you deal with. He's an evil person. I need to justify, I need to whitewash Yiftach? Person is willing to sacrifice his daughter, person is willing to slaughter 42,000 Israelites. Okay, he's a shofet b'Yisrael. A shofet is a shofet. But remember how the story began. God, do to us whatever you want. Just save us today. God says, fine, I'll send you Yiftach. Right, sometimes you get the leaders you deserve. But says the Medrash, if I'm looking at the story of what happened to Bat Yiftach, take it quite literally. And here you have a person who may have started off well, but that's not where he ended up. Where he ended up is, in fact, culturally more akin to the regional influences of the idolatry of the time. Now, the other somewhat mislabeled issue in this Medrash is that it labels the idolatry of child sacrifice as the idolatry of Baal. Baal was less a child sacrifice focused ritual than was Molech. Molech is really the child sacrifice ritual culture.
And that's from a different group?
Right. So the Molech is the deity of Ammon, which happens to be interesting because he's fighting Ammon. Right? He's fighting Ammon. Now that's an interesting question to itself. However, and I'll show you an example of some sort, can't call it precedent because it hasn't happened yet, but some sort of example of this kind of behavior, just so you see culturally where it's coming from. Take a look at Malachim Bet Perek Gimel.
So if he's following the culture, then he's just part of life.
That's what the Medrash says. Part of life. Except that he's an Israelite leader and leader of the Jewish people, so, you know, which culture is he following? That's part of the problem. And you understand the significance of the issue. Malachim Bet Perek Gimel. The story here is a battle between the kings, the united alliance of the kings of Israel and Yehuda. It's one of those few times when Israel and Yehuda got together to wage as a political alliance, and joined forces with Melech Edom in order to fight a war against Mesha, king of Moab. Pasuk Dalet, Mesha Melech Moab, Vayanaked, Vayishiv Melech Yisrael, Me'alef Karim, Vayihi, Kimot Achav, Vayifshah Melech Moab, Melech Yisrael. After the death of Achav, Melech Moab rebels against Israel, and Melech Moab is down here, and asserts his own independence, power, and authority. In order to deal with the threat, Melech Yisrael and Melech Yehuda line up with Melech Edom in the south in a combined force in order to, and they needed Melech Edom because they need to get to his land, and they wage war against Moab. Melech Moab's name is Mesha. Take a look at the end of the story, Pasuk Chaf Vav. In the midst of battle, Vaya Melech Moav ki chazak mimenu hamilchama. Melech Moav saw that he was being outflanked and outbattled. Vayikach otosh vamiot ishalif cherev lav kiad Melech Moav lo yachol. Took 700 sharpshooters in an effort to break Melech Moav. The Melech Edom was unsuccessful. The key here, from Moav's perspective, is divide and conquer. Separate Edom from Yisrael and Yehuda. What does Edom have to do with Yisrael and Yehuda anyway? Unsuccessful. So, Vayikach et bno habachor, asher yimloch tachtav, took his oldest son, who will reign in his stead, Vaya'aleu ola al hachoma, and he offered him as a sacrifice on the wall. Vayhi ketzef gadol al Yisrael. There was a great ketzef, great anger against Israel. Vayisumi alav yashuv al-aretz. He managed to escape and went back to his land. This war ends in a stalemate. Israel is victorious. Israel is winning. Israel is decimating Moab. Melech Moab, in an act of desperation, takes b'no ha-bachor she'imloch tachtav, brings him up to the wall in a public place, offers him as a sacrifice. Great anger kindled against Israel, and the war ends in a stalemate. So first of all, we learn something very important about Melech Moav, namely...
child sacrifice.
That child sacrifice in the midst of battle is not an uncommon cultural phenomenon. It's sort of, in a way, when you think about the deities of Ammon and Moab, and remember that they're connected, Molech and Chemosh, it's a way of appeasing the gods. From a pagan perspective, if you're losing, you need to appease your god. You need to offer your god something, in the mindset of a pagan idolatrous culture, something that would resolve that tension or win over their favor. And so the way to do that is to offer a sacrifice.
But he offered his son that was going to be the next one in line.
Of course, there's no greater sacrifice than your own heir to the throne, right? Some of the Forshim say that it actually wasn't an heir to his throne that he was offering as a sacrifice. It was an heir to the throne of Edom. And that the reason why Edom had joined forces with Israel is because king of Moab had captured the son of king of Edom as kind of a kidnapping. And therefore Edom was angry, so he wanted to get him back. And in the midst of battle, when Moab wanted to break ranks of Edom and Israel, he publicly sacrificed the king of Edom's son as a kind of... But that interprets it as a political action, right? Not as a religious action. But it's more likely, in the shot of the story, is that this was a religious act.
This would have been his son.
But the fascinating part of the story is, why is there an anger kindled against Israel?
Yeah.
Right.
What's going on there?
Great indignation, it says, against Israel.
Against Israel. What has it got to do with Israel? Ketzev Gadol Yisrael doesn't come from the enemy. Ketzev Gadol Yisrael comes from God.
No matter what happens.
So why is God angry at Israel because Melech Moav sacrificed his son on the altar?
The Jews always get blamed.
Right.
Even
by God.
Even by God? We got blamed for his sacrifice? So I'll tell you what I heard from Rav Medan. I haven't seen this written anywhere, but I heard it from Rav Medan. It's an unbelievable insight. Remember that the Jew, why did we, throughout this period of time, Shoftim, and even in Sefer Melachim, part of the issue in this whole period of time is that every time we go through these cycles of enemies, it's because
Israel sinned.
Because we sinned. And when it says that Israel sinned, what does it mean? It means that we were being brought into the cultural world of the idolatrous pagan cultures of the time. How did the story of Yiftach begin? not just one deity and one God, but with a complete disintegration of any kind of centralized focus of Avodat Hashem, to the point where it describes the Israel worshipping the Baalim and Ashtarot and the gods of Aram, Elohei Tidon, Elohei Moab, Elohei Bnei Amon. So Israel is worshipping the gods of Ammon and Moab. That means that Israel is guilty of child sacrifice. It's part of their cultural icon. That's not too dissimilar from the world of Ahab. What happened in the time? We're talking about just in the aftermath of the period of Ahab. Ahab brought idolatry of Baal and Molech and all of the cultures of idolatry into the heartland of Israel. So they're now, a generation later, they're going to fight against Melech Moab. And in the midst of the battle, and they're winning, and they're winning, and they're winning, and in the midst of the battle, suddenly, up on the wall, in a very public place, Melech Moab makes a public sacrifice. What do the Jews do at that moment?
Retreat.
What do the Jews do? They're in the middle of the battle, and suddenly, to use a modern analogy, the bells, the sound of the call to prayer gets turned on. Right? Oh, sacrifice on the wall. What do you think the Jews did at that moment? Public sacrifice, Molech, God, deities, pagans, public place, in the midst of battle. What did the Jews do?
They must participate in something.
I think they all bowed Kohim.
They all what?
Bowed Kohim. Sacrifice. What do you do when you walk past a shul in the same Kedusha? Lahavdil. You stop. You join. Right? You can't. I can't. You have to stop, hold your feet together, and say Kedusha because they're saying Kedusha. No? Melech Moab is saying Kedusha. So what do the Jews do? Bowed Kohim. We'll go back to the battle as soon as the sacrifice is finished. But at that point, there's no battle to go back to. How does the story of Yiftach begin? All of the idolatrous cultures of the time are infiltrating into the land of Israel. Would it surprise anybody that the leadership of Israel, therefore, is guilty of a pagan mentality? I'd go one step further. Who is Yiftach? Let's go back to Yiftach's origin and background. Where does Yiftach start from? Rewind the tape all the way back to the beginning of the story of Yiftach. Right?
He had a problem with his mother.
He has a problem with his mother, problem with his brothers. Yeah. In the end, as a very young man, Yiftach was exiled. And where did he go to? He doesn't go to the north of Israel, or he leaves the Gilad, so he goes, settles in Yerushalayim, or in Ramat Gan, or in Petach Tikvah, or in who knows where. He goes to Eretz Tov. There's a huge debate as to where Eretz Tov is. It's either up here in Mesopotamia, or out here in the area of Bnei Amon. And he grows up in Eretz Tov. Any surprise, therefore, that Yiftach, in the core of his identity, is more pagan than he is Israelite? Is it an accident that the Gilatites don't want to go to Yiftach to make him as their leader? They need not a pagan to be their leader. And the proof is here: he's in the midst of battle. What are the kings of Ammon and Molech and Moab, and what do all of these cultures do in the midst of battle when they want to invoke their gods to help them fight their battles? They take an oath, they make sacrifices. Right? Molech. Meshe Melech Moav. Child sacrifice. Not unprecedented. What does Yiftach do? Takes a public oath. God, give me this enemy into my hands, and I will offer you the first sacrifice of the first person to walk out of my house. Now the only question is to figure out which person he intended. But at least I understand the context. He could have meant his wife. He could have meant his servants. Any one of his servants would be expendable. Meshe Melech Moav style, he could have meant his sons. He has one daughter. It's also possible, although you'd have to argue it, but it's also possible that he meant nobody, that he meant a kind of appeasement. Right? God, get me through this, and I'll offer you a sacrifice, whoever walks out of my house. But it's a public statement. Now, the public, the newspapers print the next day, Yiftach, he, height of battle, takes an oath. First person to walk out the door, front door, is going to be offered as on the ritual, on the pagan altar of Molech. I guarantee you, for the next 24 hours, everybody's going to use the back door. Right, maybe that's what Yiftach meant, make a public statement. Nobody will be stupid enough to come out the front door. Nebuchadnezzar's daughter didn't get the memo.
Still the problem of understanding how he would make that kind of oath to Hashem unless he knew nothing about the Torah and what the prohibition on human sacrifice.
For a guy who grew up in Eretz Tov, yes, I wouldn't expect him to know anything about Jewish culture.
Right.
I expect him to walk into the role and try. So it says that Vayidon Eder al Hashem. What does that mean? He said, okay, what's the name of your God? Your God, what's his name? Oh, Hashem. Okay, God, make the oath to God. It doesn't mean anything to him. He's a pagan. One more God in the pantheon of gods? When it says Vayidai Neder El Hashem for a pagan, that means nothing. It's another name. But in his cultural core of his being, what does he see? What does he know? What does he understand as a mechanism for invoking the gods, either to appease the god of the enemy? Remember, he's fighting Ammon. So maybe he figures if he offers a sacrifice, it'll appease the god of Molech to help their side. Beat Ammon at his own game. Or he really believes that this is the way you serve God, and what does he know from anything else? Just calls it Hashem, calls it something else.
All of his bases, right?
Yeah.
But that's so, on the one hand, you know, a few weeks ago when we talked about it, that he goes out to Ammon to try and convince him not to wage war, what's with me and you, and he goes through this whole history of Israel,
right.
So he doesn't sound like such an ignoramus, and he's trying
right.
to avoid bloodshed, and then he offers somebody walking out of his house. It seems a little
you could, unless you could say that his political analysis was well
just
prompted
political.
By good advisors. You know, he's got his history right, but that doesn't necessarily, you can be a very good historian and not and culturally not be sensitive to the internal dynamic of what's appropriate for Israel. Especially when the whole country is ablaze with idolatry, with paganism. It's not a surprise. When the Medrash says this is coming from Shevet Ephraim, not from Bnei Ammonah, I'm prepared to at least give him the credit to suggest that the influence is coming from Eretz Tov, coming from outside sources. But at least from that perspective, the story is what it is, and it's not a nice story, and it's not a happy story with a happy ending, but that's because Yiftach, Nebuch, is a pagan in upbringing and in identity and in culture, and who's to blame? In the end, if this is the interpretation, who's to blame here?
His upbringing,
his family.
His brothers who exiled him to Eretz Tov in the first place. Correct. Well, that's one possibility.
So maybe he didn't care who it was. Maybe because you're saying his upbringing, he was so, you know, he wasn't brought up properly, so therefore what did he care who it was who walked out of the house?
Yeah. Except that he didn't want it to be his daughter. Yeah, he only has one daughter, after all. I understand that. All right. That is one possibility. Another possibility, however, in the Gemara and in the Medrash, the classic Midrashim, let's say, the same issue as to the death of Bat Yiftach, which, again, we're going to still end up in the same place. We're going to still end up with a pagan leader who's prepared to sacrifice his daughter because of stupidity. But they weren't so prepared to suggest that, like Meshe Melech Moav, he was just looking for human sacrifice for the sake of appeasing gods. And so the Gemara has a somewhat different take on the story, that at least his intention, when he set out in the first place, that his intention was good. It ended up in the wrong place, but at least his intention was good. So Gemara in Tainis says the following. Source number one. Amar Shmuel ben Nachmeni, Amar Rabbi Yonatan. Shlosha sha'alu shelo kohogen, l'shnayim hishivu kohogen, l'achad hishivu shelo kohogen. There are three cases in Tanakh where a person made a request that was inappropriate, formulated in an inappropriate manner. However, in two of those cases, the result was fine, the result was positive, God turned it into a positive, and God, on the contrary, responded in such a way that made it not appropriate. What are the cases? The first is Eliezer Eved Avram. Eliezer's whole condition upon which he predicates the finding of Rivka, the finding of wife Yitzchak, this deal he makes with God at the well, says, that's not appropriate. You don't make deals with God. God, if you do this, then I'll do this. And if not, then you don't make deals with God. But because his intentions were good and because of the people involved and because of the nature of the request, it ended up positively. Similarly, Shaul ben Kish, when Shaul goes looking for his father's lost donkeys, he says, okay, we'll go to the Navi if you find, abuse of the Navi, let's say. Use the Navi to ask him where my father's donkeys are. And the third, of course, is Yiftach HaGiladi. Yiftach HaGiladi, I skipped the other two, but let's go to Yiftach. Yiftach HaGiladi Dechtiv, V'haya HaYotzeh Ashi Yetzeh Midaltei Beiti. How does he formulate his request? The one that comes out of my house, or that which comes out of my house. What do you mean, that which? That's how you make an offering? That's how you make a sacrifice? Yechol Afilu Davar Tameh? And what is something impure, meaning something unkosher, walked out of your house? Now that's not an arbitrary question. Remember that sacrifices are only kosher from domesticated animals like cows, goats, chickens. Those kinds of animals don't usually live in your house. What usually lives inside your house?
A cat, a dog.
Those are not kosher animals.
But you would think that it would be implied that it would only be the kosher
animals. Oh, so we'll see that in the next Medrash. Take a look in source 3, the second paragraph. Same source, same discussion, just a different version of it appears in the Medrash. Before I do that, let's just finish where we were. Yechol afilu davar tameh, maybe something impure. Therefore, heshivo shelo kohogen, God responded in a way that made it inappropriate. Nizdamna lo bito, and it ended up being his daughter. Now, does that mean that God intended for Yiftach to sacrifice his daughter? No. All God wanted to do is to demonstrate to Yiftach that he slipped, that his oath was formulated inappropriately. And therefore, the Gemara continues and says, "V'ha'inu deka amar luhu navi liYisrael hatzari em begiladim rofe ensham." Is there no doctor in Israel? Is there nobody to heal in Israel? Is there no prophet in Israel? Uchdiva shelo tziviti velo dibarti velo talibi. I never commanded this thing. I never considered this thing. Ashelo tziviti. I never commanded. That refers to Benosha Melech Moav, the son of Melech Moav, who offered his son as a sacrifice. And I just read you those pesukim. Velo dibarti. I never spoke such a thing. Zeyiftach. Three cases of child sacrifice in Tanakh. I intentionally did not want a human sacrifice. Meshach Melech Moav is a pagan. Avraham understood this is a no. Yiftach couldn't get the message. I wanted him to trip. I wanted him to see that you don't make a blanket oath that says whatever walks out of my house. Davatame, are you going to offer a dog or a cat on the Mizbeach? So the absurdity would be that it would be a human being. Yiftach, who is still, at the end of the day, pagan, human beings, so be it. The way the Medrash formulates it, it's even more intense, because the Medrash spells it out in the second paragraph in Source 3. V'haya yotze asher yetze midatei beiti, v'aliti hu ola la'ashem. Ha'ili yetza chamor, a kelev, a chatul, haya maleo ola? A dog or a cat? Not only that, if you look at the next paragraph in the Medrash, there's a discussion as to whether or not this oath is even valid. Forget for a moment the fact that he offers her. Clearly he was never should never have offered her as a sacrifice. That's clear. question is, what validity did this oath have? That which comes out of my house, what's his intention? According to this approach, his intention is some kind of an animal. Right? But a human being walks out. So what happens then?
No, I mean, it doesn't make sense.
It doesn't make any sense, right? It should be null and void. So what happens in the next paragraph is a debate, halachic debate, between Rabbi Yochanan and Reish Lakish. What kind of validity does such an oath have? Rabbi Yochanan is of the opinion that says, Hekdesh damim hayachayav, that such an oath requires a person to pay a monetary value equal to the value of a human being. Now, the value of a human being doesn't mean what is a person worth. It means that we have a concept in the Torah called Erchin. It's a mitzvah in the end of Parshat Bechukotai, where a person can take an oath and say, the value of so-and-so is I pledge to the temple the value of Reuven. How do you evaluate Reuven? So the Torah says it's a stipulated amount of money based on age, capability, workforce, etc. We evaluate, it means how much. There's two ways to do it. Either there's a fixed amount per age of a person, or based on what a person is able to earn or to make in a living, that's what his net worth. It's like a matching fund, like a matching pledge.
It's like what the courts do.
Right?
It's a civil judgment.
Yeah. So that's exactly what Rabbi Yochanan says. He says, if you take an oath to give a human being to the temple, all it means is that you're making an oath to give a financial stipend to the temple. Nobody intends it to be mean that you can offer a human being. V'Reish Lakish Omer, afilu hekdesh damim lo achayav. According to Reish Lakish, you're not chayav in anything. Right? If you take an oath, there's a Mishnah that says, if you take an oath to give an animal as a sacrifice, and the animal happens to be tamei, or it happens to be a balmum, so you're exempt, because you offered this animal is invalid as an offering, you're exempt, it's done. So, according to that, Yiftach, there was never intention for, when Yiftach took the oath, given the benefit of the doubt, he meant a korban. I want to bring a korban to Hashem. I want to bring something. I want to make some kind of a pledge. Today we'd make a monetary pledge at Tzedakah. In the time of the temple, you made a pledge of a korban. But he's not yet versed in the protocols of Jewish life. So he doesn't understand that you don't just make a blanket statement to whatever walks out of my house. You know, there's a formula, Harei Alai Ola, Harei Alai Behemazu. Right? There's formulas to the protocol to how you make an offering to the temple. He doesn't know those formulas. So he trips. And he says, whatever walks out of my house. So God wanted him to see how much he tripped. God orchestrated it so that his daughter walked out of the house. But Nebuch, this pagan, doesn't understand. So he takes his order, he tears Kriya, he cries, and then he says, no, what can I do? But see, to be at Hashem, I opened up my mouth to God. Clearly, I can't renege God. Whatever you say, you have to do. It's a distortion of all of the concepts in Jewish life. He's trying to bring make an offering to God in the temple and transforming it into a pagan mentality. And that's exactly the problem of Yiftach. He's this hybrid of Israel leader and pagan upbringing. There's even a third possibility. The third possibility is the Ramban. It's really wild. It's a wild Ramban. We've been assuming up until now that... What time we got to 10:30? Mm-hmm. We've been assuming up until now that such oaths that Yiftach takes are unprecedented. This is really extraordinary type of oath. Un-Jewish. And therefore resulting in some kind of pagan ritual. The Ramban points us in a different direction and says, not so fast. Yiftach may have been ignorant, but that's because he didn't understand the nuances, but the precedent here is not so off the mark. And he takes us to two places in Chumash. So let's start. Let's take a look at those two places. The first is in Bamidbar Perek Chaf Aleph. Bamidbar Perek Chaf Aleph, the beginning of the Perek, there's a little story. This is in year 40. As Israel is traveling through. It's just before the battle with Sichon. Vayishma Knani Melech Arad Yosheva Negev Kibay Yisrael Derech Atarim. King of Arad hears that Israel was coming through the south. Vayilachem BeYisrael Vayishp Mimenu Shevi. They begin a war with Israel. And they take captives. Meaning, who had the upper hand in that battle? At the beginning, who has the upper hand?
Arad.
Vayida Yisrael neder lahashem vayoma. Israel took an oath to God, saying, Im naton titen et ha'am hazeh biyadi, if you will give me this nation into my hands, v'hacharamti et arayhem, I will obliterate their cities. I will make them a cherem. Vayishma Hashem b'kol Yisrael, vayiten et haknani, vayacharem et hem ve'et arehem. God heeded their cry, gave them their enemies, and they destroyed them and their cities. Vayacharem et hem ve'et arehem. This is the clearest parallel precedent to Yiftach's neder. In the middle of battle, takes an oath, if you will give, and even the phraseology of the oath is the same. Im naton titen, Yiftach's neder, im naton titen et bnei amam biyadi. The result, of course, is a little different. The second is the precedent for this, halachic precedent for this oath, is in Vayikra, Perek Chaf Zayin. Vayikra Perek Chaf Zayin is in Parsha B'chukosai. It's exactly that passage about Erchin that we talked about before. Right? Oaths to the temple and values, etc. Two psukim that are really quite astounding. And they need to be understood because they're almost contradictory. Pasuk Chavchet. Actually, let's start with Chavzayin. Im bebehemah tme'ah, if a person gives as an oath behemah tme'ah, an unkosher animal, ufada be'erkecha, and you can redeem it for its value, ויסב חמישיתו עליו, and add a fifth. ואם לא יגאל ונמכר בערכך. If you don't redeem it, then it has to be sold. What do you do if you give an animal that's tame as an offer? אך כל חרם. Now, the word חרם is a fascinating word. We talked about the word when we learned Sefer Yoshua. Correct. By the חרם of Yericho. חרם can mean excommunication. חרם can mean a dedication to the temple, hekdesh. Cherem can mean obliteration or destruction. It's a word that can mean actually both positive and negative. If I give something as cherem lahashem, it means that I'm giving something to the temple. Cherem lahashem can also mean if I machrim something, I destroy it. So kol cherem asher yachrim ish lahashem mikol ashelo. Any cherem that a person takes of that which he has, that which is his, Me Adam ubehema umisteach uzato. If you offer a cherem of that which is yours, whether it be a cherem of a person, an animal, a field, lo yimecheh velo yigael. You're not allowed to sell that item, not allowed to redeem that item. Kol cherem kodesh kodeshimu laHashem, it's holy unto God. Kol cherem. Asher yochra min ha'adam any cherem that you make of a human being, lo yipadeh, cannot be redeemed, mot yumat, must be put to death.
Who must be put to death?
Good question.
The person?
That's what it says.
Which person?
The object of the oath. The object of the oath.
You can kill them?
You cannot redeem that person, the subject of that oath, but rather must be
killed.
If I read this literally, am I finding precedent for Yiftach's oath?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, there's a contradiction between these two psukim. A glaring contradiction. What's the contradiction? In what context? Why is that a contradiction? Maybe they're talking about two different things. Look at Me'adam u'mebehema. Correct. So Pasuk Chavchet talks about a cherem of Adam, the result of which is that the Adam is Kodesh La'Hashem. Whatever that means, it's Kodesh La'Hashem.
Which means you can't sacrifice it? Or it means
I don't know what it means, but whatever it is, it's Kodesh La'Hashem. It belongs to the temple. Then I have Pasuk Chavchet, which says, if I make a cherem of Adam, I can't redeem it, it has to be put to death.
Yeah.
What are we talking about? So now take a look at the Ramban. And the Ramban is the one who links these two psukim to the story of Yiftach. So first of all, the Ramban is trying to understand these two, the pshat of these two psukim. This is Ramban on those two on in his Perish and Chumash. V'alderech ha-pshat. Yomar ha-katuv. Kol ha-machrim mishelo. The Pasuk says, mishelo mi-adam u-be'ema. Anybody who offers as a cherem that which belongs to him, what belongs to a person? Ben Adam ben Beima v'sadeh chuzato. How can a person belong to a person?
A slave.
A servant, a slave, right? We have such a thing as an Eviknani. If a person is machrim, designates as cherem, anything that belongs to him, Adam, Beima, Sadeh, the result is Shehen charemim lakohanim. They now become the property of the Kohen. So a way of taking an Eved and taking him out of your service and giving him over to the service of the temple is you make him a cherem, which means essentially it's another way of saying he's a makdishim, I designate him to the temple. That's fine. Aval ha-machrim min ha-adam she'eino shelo. Second pasuk, says the Ramban, is talking about a cherem of a person that does not belong to him. What kind of a cherem of a person does not belong to you? So we're not talking about a servant. What are we talking about? Says the Ramban. Kigon hanilchamim al oivehem. That's a cherem you take in the midst of battle. When you're fighting against an enemy. V'nodrim neder, and you take an oath. Like Bnei Yisrael took him by Midbar Perchav Aleph. Im naton titen et ha'am hazeh biyadiva acharamti et arayhem, I will obliterate their cities. What's that about? Yamutu kol adam nimtza behem. Then you kill everybody you find. Meaning, we talked about this once when we did Yoshua. There are two types of battles in Tanakh. There are two types of wars you can campaigns you can fight. You can fight a campaign whose purpose it is to capture your enemy alive and enslave them. And you can fight a battle whose purpose it is to come to an absolute resolution, victor and vanquished. The difference is that in the first type of battle, if you want them alive as slaves, you besiege the city, you take your time, and you squeeze them out till they surrender, and then they're your slaves. Whereas the latter is you're fighting, whether it be over territory, over the land of Israel, or over authority. You engage the enemy, and you continue the fight until or they surrender or they leave. Right? In other words, the formulation of a battle that says, I'm not going to take captives in this battle. I'm not looking to fill my quota of slaves and booty of war. I'm looking for a decisive victory. That's the kind of battle in which you say, Cherem Lashem, meaning I'm going to fight this battle until the end. I'm not fighting this battle for the purpose of spoils, like I'm fighting this battle for victory. That's exactly what Yeshua did in Yericho. That's the kind of neder that you're not offering to the Kohanim. You're saying nothing in this city is permissible. You're saying this city is now off limits. I'm going to make it asur b'ana. I'm going to make it prohibited to derive any benefit from it. That's exactly the precedent to cherem that Yehoshua took on Yericho. Says the Ramban, that was Yiftach's mistake. Chashav kasher charam nagid Yisrael. He thought that because this cherem was taken by the leader of Israel, then chal v'kayam lahamit anashim, then it's valid even against people. He was so caught up in his status as leader, as king, as rosh, as nagid, power and authority, that he didn't realize that it's not a literal reading of the text, it's not a literal statement. If I make something cherem, then I can offer them as a sacrifice. It has a halachic context. It has a meaning. It means you fight the battle until the end. If you want to take an oath and say, give them into my hands and I'll destroy the enemy, B'nai Amon, and I'll make sure that they never raise their hands against Israel again and we'll fight this victory till the end, that makes sense. You want to make an oath that says you want to give something to the Kohanim, something to the Beis HaMikdash, Aganeved, that makes sense. But to take an oath that you're going to take a person and bring them as a sacrifice, that was never the part of the intent. That's a distortion of the reading of the text, says the Ramban. His own status as Nagid, as leader, as authority, as power, got in his way of his understanding of the meaning of this chair. The precedent was here. The interpretation was incorrect. So let me stop here and essentially conclude that we have looked today at two primary schools of thought. Both of them ending with the position that Yiftach, either because of his arrogance sense of power, and or because of his pagan upbringing, doesn't understand that such an oath is not only inappropriate in the eyes of the Torah, it's evil. But Yiftach is a pagan. And in the end, that's what we've got. We've got a Yiftach who grew up in Eretz Tov, influenced by B'nai Amon. And whether he's intentionally meaning human sacrifice or got caught or tripped into human sacrifice, he ends up reverting to his cultural pagan origins in his application of the oath against his daughter. School number one. Next week, B'zat Hashem, we're going to flip it and look at school number two, which says that he never was guilty of human sacrifice, he never sacrificed her, he never killed her, he never did anything to her except give her over to the temple to serve God in the purest way possible. That's a subject that requires a whole shiur unto itself. That, B'zat Hashem, is our next agenda.
What kind of positions? I like that one.